Dr. Manny Marable is the author of 18 books, including Black Leadership, Speaking Truth to Power, Beyond Black and White, Race Reform and Rebellion, How Capital Underdeveloped Black America, and his latest book, The Great Wells of Democracy, The Meaning of Race in American Life. He is also a professor of history, political science, and public policy at Columbia University in New York, and is director of the Institute in African American Studies. And welcome to WBAI, Manny Marable.
Thank you. It's always great to be on BAI.
Manny, why did you write this book, and to whom is it aimed at, and why?
Well, The Great Wells of Democracy, The Meaning of Race in American Life, I feel, is the most important book that I've written. I've written almost 20 books over the last quarter century, but certainly it's the most interesting book, I think, from the standpoint of being accessible to a broad public audience. The Great Wells of Democracy is an African-American's personal journey through the issues of race, interrogating issues of race and racism in 21st century America. It's a synthesis of scholarship and personal reflections and my experiences examining structural racism. And there are a variety of stories that I tell in the book. I begin with when I was 17 years old and Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in April the 4th, 1968. I was a senior in high school, and my mother thought it would be a great idea for me to travel to Atlanta to cover the funeral for the African-American newspaper in Dayton, Ohio, the Dayton Black Press. I flew there, and I was actually the very first person there that morning at Ebenezer Baptist Church for the funeral. I walked along with the mourners to Atlanta University, where Dr. Benjamin Mays gave the eloquent eulogy for Dr. King. That's the beginning of the book, and I describe from that experience how I've come to understand sites of resistance and race in American life. My chapter on the prison industrial complex begins at Sing Sing Prison, where over the last 7 years I've lectured to African American prisoners in the New York Theological Seminary's course there. I talk about my relationship with Russell and Danny Simmons in the hip-hop chapter and begin the chapter with the thousands and thousands of young people who showed up in downtown New York in June of 2002 to demonstrate on behalf of public education against the Bloomberg administration's cuts. So The Great Wells of Democracy takes up issues of racism, I try to do that from the point of view, the vantage point of an African American's negotiation with the roots of modern racism in the post-civil rights era. I'm aiming the book at a general audience, although in a general way, I always write to African Americans in the sense that when an author attempts to envision to whom she or he is addressing, I generally write for African Americans, but since this is not a race-based discourse, white folk are more than entitled to listen in. But the book is designed for a general audience, and to some extent it is designed to make white Americans understand how structural racism is alive and well in the 21st century. The signs reading white and black have been taken down, but the deep structure of racialized power, historically constructed, accumulated disadvantage that burdens the African American community, that indeed is alive and well, and The Great Wells of Democracy tries to speak to those issues.
Manny, let's get down to the meat of the book and some of the things and issues that you've raised up. First of all, you talked about the national narrative on democracy and how they are defined differently amongst different people, and it's one of the central themes of your book. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. And in fact, actually, the jumping off point is the title, The Great Wells of Democracy. Martin Luther King Jr. used that phrase in a number of speeches and writings. But for King, he used the phrase, the great wells of democracy, to speak to the so-called commitment that is ensconced in the Declaration of Independence, of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the individual liberties that are expressed in the Constitution's Bill of Rights. He's pointing to these wellsprings of democracy, these traditions that were historically denied to people of African descent and Latinos and women and indeed most white males who could not vote if they did not own property in the late 18th century. The paradox is that these democratic rights did not extend to African Americans. And King uses this phrase specifically in the letter from Birmingham Jail and in his very last speech on April the 3rd, 1968, the I've Been to the Mountaintop address. What King is saying is the culmination, the paradox of democracy in America is that the people who have been most severely denied democratic rights, the African American movement, the African American people, our struggle for justice and for freedom is actually the highest expression of democratic rights. The great wellspring of democracy extends through the writings and activism of Frederick Douglass and Paul Robeson and Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, their activism, Fannie Lou Hamer, Dr. Du Bois, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey. That militant tradition of black freedom struggle is really the best and highest expression of democracy in this country. And that's the narrative that white Americans, most white Americans, don't hear and don't get. And that's what the book tries to lay out, that is, the narrative of democracy from the vantage point of people of African descent.
Let's talk about the definition of race. What is your definition of race, and just what is structural racism that you raise up in your book, and how has this affected the quest for democracy in America?
The Great Wells of Democracy argues that America was constructed on a racial foundation. Before there was a Declaration of Independence, there was structural racism. Before the Puritans actually landed at Plymouth Rock, we were here, and the foundations of structural racism were being laid in the Jamestown, Virginia community. The term race really is meaningless, as our listeners know. That is, the category has been debunked for decades by biologists, by cultural anthropologists. But while race is not real, racism indeed is very real. The historically constructed exploitation of the labor power and the degradation, the oppression of people of African descent as they have existed in the Western Hemisphere and in the continent of Africa, in the African diaspora, is what we mean by racism. The stereotyping, in fact, in The Great Wells of Democracy, I call racism the three P's, prejudice, power, and privilege. And each one is important. Prejudice, the stereotyping of people of African descent, and by extension, other people of color, in which, in a society where whiteness is defined at the top and blackness is defined at the bottom, power, the use of institutional resources to carry out the prejudice, and white privilege, that is, simply by being white, not based on merit, not based on hard work, certainly, but simply by being white in a racist society, you have relative prerequisites, you have perks, privileges, dare we say quotas, through which whiteness exercises its own prerogatives. You put combine prejudice, power, and privilege, and you've got a structure of racial inequality. That is structural racism. And so we've changed the laws, and we've changed the public discourse of very few white people. Even Trent Lott embraced, rhetorically, affirmative action, because he wanted to hold on to his Senate majority seat. Nevertheless, the reality is that while the names have been changed to protect the guilty, the dynamics of prejudice, power, and privilege, still on roll in 21st century America.
You quoted A.T.M. Balibar's thesis on racism as transcending national states. Can you explain that?
Yes, that racism is a kind of historiosophy, as Balibar puts it. In other words, a blend of history and philosophy, whereby the purpose or the function ideologically of the racist is to establish the illegitimacy of the history, the identity, the being of that person or that group that is being racialized. And it is to utilize this bogus history, this, you know, back when I was in graduate school, the professors used to teach, white professors would say, well, Africa has no history. So it is to obliterate the history of the oppressed. It is to obliterate their identity. This is what Althusser referred to as overdetermination. That is, you cease as a person of color to be the person for whom you are and how you define your identity. And what is imposed on you is a stereotype, is a distorted, it's a bigoted image or stereotype that is the construct of the racist. So that in a racist society, the quote-unquote black person is the construction of what is in the racist mind. And that is imposed on us. And so, in effect, that's how the NYPD could look at Amadou Diallo, see a wallet, and then say, we saw a gun. That is the imposition of stereotyping, of prejudice. And then you add the power of the state and the prerequisites, the privileges of whiteness. And so you have then a very sophisticated form of racialization, the process of being raced.
Manning, out of the American slave system, you say grew two distinct trains of political thought, embodied in both Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney. How did this develop, and how does it affect current political thought among African Americans?
Well, this observation is not new, but my spin on it, I think, is, or my interpretation of it is, if one looks at the ideological and cultural contours of black America over the last 150 years, one is struck by a continuing debate between what most historians describe as integrationism versus black nationalism. Or in my book, The Great Wells of Democracy, I call it state-based reform versus race-based reform. State-based reforms have been those efforts at social and political change launched by generally middle-class African Americans to achieve assimilation within the existing structures of society, so that the vehicle to affect legal change, that is, access to the mainstream, has generally been mounted, almost always been mounted, through the state, that is, through political reforms, getting the government to outlaw slavery, getting the government or the courts to outlaw Plessy versus Ferguson, to achieve, as Charles Hamilton Houston did and as Thurgood Marshall did, the decisions that culminated in Brown v. Board in 1954. If you brought Frederick Douglass and Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and Jesse Jackson all to the table, spanning 150 years, they would all basically say the same thing. That is, the integration of the Negro into American and mainstreams of American life, the end of the kind of residential segregation that constructs the ghetto, etc. And it's their strategy. Now, a counter strategy is represented by Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Louis Farrakhan, a long tradition going all the way back to Martin R. Delaney and Henry Highland Garnett of black nationalism. And that's race-based. And basically, the nationalist perspective is that you can't trust white liberals and you can't trust the white political system. We need to build strong black institutions that provide goods and services to black folk and develop and enhance structural capacity to change the material conditions of black life. Those two tendencies have fought back and forth over the last 150 years. In my book, I argue that both of these strategies now have reached a dead end, but for different reasons.
And the reasons are?
State-based integration or reform has run into a dead end because of the collapse of the liberal coalition, the New Deal, the Great Society, traditional, what we used to call the liberal establishment. That's pretty much dead. The Democratic Party has bought lock, stock, and barrel neoliberal economic policies and a neoliberal political strategy. And so in this era of George W. Bush and the Republican hegemony in Congress, with the marginalization of liberals within the Democratic Party, it is almost impossible for the liberal integrationist approach to affect mainstream policy in a fundamental way. The nationalist strategy or the race-based strategy runs into problems for different kinds of reasons. One, most African Americans today live in multiracial, multiethnic communities. Harlem is over 40% Latino right now. Latinos and African Americans represent, and again, it's difficult to talk about the Latino population without noting that there's tremendous national and ethnic variation within the category of quote-unquote Hispanic, defined by the U.S. Bureau of the Census. But we're living in a period where people of African descent are no longer numerically, using the category of the census, the largest racialized minority population in the U.S. So that race-based strategies, mom-and-pop capitalism, cannot work in a period of globalization. Capital is global and transnational. And so strategies of building black capacity using private market initiatives or simply developing ethnic enclaves, those kinds of strategies of narrow nationalism, cannot transform the conditions of the communities in which we live. So what is needed is something that goes beyond both the state-based integrationist approaches and the traditional nationalist approaches. And that's what the book tries to lay out in the second half of my argument in the text.
A section of the book deals with, of course, the post-civil rights era, which you were speaking about, and you mentioned a few folks, and the development of the black middle class. And you talked about the failures of the electoral political system, failure of the criminal justice system.
And the death of the talented tenth.
And I got that down there, too. And the education system, and black political leaders to advance the dialogue about the burden of racism in American life. Talk about those failures.
Well, in the book, The Great Wells of Democracy, the book is really divided into three sections. The first section is a short history of structural racism, and I try to lay out the argument that a U.S. democracy is fundamentally flawed because it's constructed on a racial foundation. And I try to show the historic pattern of historically constructed accumulated disadvantage that still plagues, that defines black folk as a subordinate social group within a hierarchically structured racist society. The second section takes up the issues you've just raised. Why is it that traditional strategies, integrationism, I talk about different initiatives on race. The two predominant ones in the 90s were Louis Farrakhan's Million Man March and its aftermath as a kind of race initiative from the nationalist standpoint. Then there was an integrationist race initiative. It was called the President Clinton's Initiative on Race. And I talk about why both of them, in a real sense, failed to consolidate a new discourse around race. The book then really interrogates the issue of black, the illusion of black advancement. It's because it really is an illusion. There is substance to the illusion, like every illusion. There's some truth to it. That is, if one looks at the black middle class today versus 40 years ago, the number of black elected officials in 1964 was less than 100. Today, it's 12,000. the black middle class quadrupled between the assassination of Martin King in 68 to the Million Man March in 1995. If blacks were a separate nation, their gross domestic product would be the ninth wealthiest nation on earth. So, you know, you have brothers and sisters who are running AOL, Time Warner, American Express, etc. So the kind of bourgeois critics point to that and say, well, you know, what do Negroes have to complain about? The answer is plenty. For the typical African-American household, I point out that the liberal approaches, liberal integrationism, has never substantively dealt with equity inequity. That is, the deep structure of economic disadvantage that defines the existence of the vast majority of black people in this country. I show in The Great Wells of Democracy, the typical black household has only one-eighth the net wealth of the average white American household. I show that here in this city, in New York, documenting a study done by Charles Schumer in 2000 and his staff, that an African American who goes into a bank in New York City in 2000 and tries to get a home mortgage has a higher rejection rate for black families who earn over $60,000 a year, has a higher rejection rate than whites who earn under $40,000 a year. And that's not in 1950 or 1960, that's in 2000. So there is a structure of white supremacy, an accumulated, historically constructed disadvantage that gets played out every day in the average life chances of black people. And in The Great Wells of Democracy, I try to show how liberal approaches and narrowly defined race-based approaches will not transform the structure of structural racism.
And of course, the educational system is another one of those failures.
It's a failure in several respects. First, I try to show in the book that there has been a deliberate underfunding of public education and the pushing of false solutions, bogus solutions, such as vouchers, which are designed to raid the scarce resources of public institutions to give millions of dollars to corporations who consider schools a sideline. So I try to establish different strategies for using education as a vehicle of empowerment, as African Americans have historically done. Nevertheless, because of a variety of issues, I'll just focus on one since we have limited time, the prison industrial complex. Here in the state of New York, between 1988 and 1998, there was almost a dollar-per-dollar trade-off between the Department of Corrections, which increased its budget by over $700 million, and a decline in the public education budget for SUNY, State University of New York, by $615 million. So I show that reductions in Pell Grants, reductions in state support for educational programs, the elimination of Pell Grants and state-supported educational programs in prison, even when we know that prisoners who are enrolled in a college educational program or college courses have only a 10% recidivism rate, only 10% return to prison. Those who aren't in educational programs, nearly 50% return. In federal institutions, 38% return within 3 years. So that by undercutting education, both in elementary and secondary schools, in our colleges, in CUNY and SUNY and other public institutions, and in our correctional facilities inside of our prisons and penitentiaries, we're seeing the underdevelopment of this generation of young black and brown people.